Our first discussion this evening will deal with the problem of aesthetics. And I suppose there is no matter under greater controversy in the world of culture today. Aesthetics, essentially, is that part of philosophy which is the concern with the nature of the beautiful. How shall we define beauty? In what way shall we establish the consequences of beauty as a vital force in the experiences of mankind? How shall we define that which is not beautiful? And determine, if possible, the consequences of beauty and that which is not beautiful upon the daily experience of human beings. Even the most conservative of our modern dictionaries are in general agreement as to the meaning of the word beautiful. And they all agree that to be beautiful, a thing must be essentially noble, that it must be harmonious, that it must convey a lofty feeling to those who behold it. In other words, to be considered beautiful, a thing must have artistic value, a value which can be readily comprehended and experienced by those without special technical knowledge of the subject. Therefore, a thing that is asymmetrical, deformed or distorted in its parts, cannot be regarded as beautiful. If we go further into the study of the word art, or to that area of knowledge which we call the art, particularly the graphic art, we come also to a rather severe and definite definition, namely that art is concerned with the cultivation and the recognition of beauty. There seems to be no doubt as to the general intention that aesthetics, as expressed through the creative art, should be a means of enriching the experience of man in the acceptance and appreciation for that which is essentially noble, pure, fine, good, and in all of its parts and relations, colors, and forms, admirable and pleasing to the sensory perceptions of man. Under such definitions, it's obvious that the classical school would come into conflict with the modern school, which holds a somewhat contrary feeling on this matter. But as long as art originated and developed for centuries within the structure of philosophy, I think we must recognize that it belongs to a descent of philosophic insight. And that part of art which is contrary to philosophy must finally be considered contrary to aesthetics. Just as surely is that part of philosophy which in one way or another separates itself from the parent structure and attempts an isolated existence, must inevitably be inferior to that total body from which it has separated itself. To the classical thinker, the search for the true nature of the beautiful was not without full recognition the difficulty with the definition of ultimate beauty, ultimate nobility, or ultimate perfection. For beauty is a kind of perfection. The classical writers, however, were of the opinion that nature again points the way. That in nature, all forms are essentially beautiful. And the various so-called accidents of nature by means of which things seem to be injured or broken, these accidents in the course of time are absorbed by nature itself into a noble compound of which no part is deficient in some kind of appreciable value. Actually, in nature, there is normalcy. And that which is normal in its fullest terms in philosophy is in order. Its parts are functioning properly. Normalcy, therefore, means agreement with some recognized norm. In this case, the norm of nature itself. So that which is in its nature natural is not in any way distorted by artificial circumstance, but which continues to manifest through its construction, through its parts, through its organization, through its function, the inevitable laws of nature, without deforming or defaming these laws. And such a structure must be harmonious, must be orderly, and in itself beautiful. Beauty is therefore order, the proper relationship of parts. And to the ancients, it was a thing of itself, although it might not have an existence apart from other things. Beauty, therefore, was present in all compounds. And it was the duty and responsibility of man to discover this beauty, serve it, release it from any bondage in which it might be involved, and give it the full recognition which it deserves. So in our study of aesthetics, we are concerned not only with the beauties of form, but with the beauties of character, the beauties of conduct, the beauties of nobility of purpose, the beauties of patience and honor. For that which in one way or another adorns virtue must be regarded as contributing beauty. Virtue in itself, perhaps, requires no definite or direct adornment. And yet, by its own nature, by the harmony of itself, it is adorned. So wherever things are right, there is a mysterious atmosphere of rightness about them. And this rightness we recognize as beauty. Now there are certainly two or more standards of beauty with which we have to struggle consistently. The Greeks were of this opinion also. There is an archetypal beauty, a beauty which is in substance eternal, inevitable, absolute. This archetypal beauty is the end of all of the questing for what constitutes the beautiful. This archetypal beauty exists forever in the divine mind, the divine consciousness, and it manifests eternally through the works of the divine as these are brought to our attention in the various departments of creation. There is also a relative beauty, a beauty which is appreciable by those who have attained various levels or degrees. This relative beauty is a stage or condition of approach to absolute beauty. Relative beauty, therefore, is that part of the eternal or the inevitable which is appreciable by us, which we can understand, which we can sense or know. And it is in the field of relative beauty that we explain the infinite diversity of artistic representation that exist in the world. We know that primitive man had standards of beauty which we regard as in some ways inferior to our own. We also know that the primitive possessed a vitality, an integrity of power, which is often lacking in the decadent art of more sophisticated people. Last Sunday, I went down to the Park Museum in Exposition Park to see the archaeological exhibit from Mexico. It's a magnificent collection of materials. But as we wander through the galleries, we cannot help but say to ourselves, this art has a certain time and date stamp upon it. It has a true greatness, a greatness which cannot be denied. Yet if one of these works of art were to be copied today by a contemporary artist, it would not be great. Nor would it be great if a contemporary artist simply went back and revitalized the entire school of the Aztec, Maya, Toltec, Zoroastrian culture. This art belonged to a time and to a people. For that time and that people, it was the fullest expression of creative aesthetics. We sense beneath the surface of it a certain degree of this vast, universal, archetypal art consciousness which we have mentioned. But it had not reached a perfect flower. It was strong. It was an honest art. It was an art which, obviously, the people not only respected but enjoyed. To us it might seem barbaric. But to them, it was undoubtedly noble, the highest and fullest expression of their own genius. Because it was honest, it will always be good. Because it was very honest in some of its manifestations, part of it will always be great. But we must recognize it as part of a great parade of changing styles, fashions, and trends in creativity. In the same exhibition, we can move from the period of the Aztec Maya art to a room devoted to the Spanish period. Here we see about as bad a group of decadent productions as anyone would ever want to look at. Productions which showed the tragic consequence of a clean, primitive people taking on the dying sophistication of a decadent master race. Here there was very little of real value. The primitive integrity was gone. A hollow copyism took its place. One in which the worst was perpetuated. Here there was everything but genius, everything but merit, everything but honesty. But because these were lacking, there was nothing. This represents very largely the story of human aesthetics. This struggle to preserve honesty, and at the same time, with honesty, to achieve true greatness, without which none of these values have enduring quality for us. I think, therefore, that in the search for beauty, we must follow the philosophic realization that beauty, like veneration, is always limited by the degree of insight possessed by the human being. We also see this when we look back upon the changing fashions of time and wonder how people a few years ago could be so far from the aesthetic standards which we recognize today. Thus, art has an outward life. a life in which it helps to mold or model our behavior. Art, however, like all branches of philosophy and also the general field of religion, must be wonderfully honest, or it is nothing. This honesty, however, is not to be measured according to the standards set up in the Latin Quarter of Paris. Honesty is not realism as we know it today. For realism, as we understand it in modern Impressionism and Post-Impressionism, is an assumption, a disillusion, an example of a prevailing neurotic tendency in man himself. Realism now assumes that whatever we commonly experience in the dying out of a culture, whatever represents the deformities of human nature and behavior, that these are the realities. That man is actually a being inevitably and eternally sick. And to present him in an artistic treatment means that this sickness must dominate the composition. He must be shown in all of his immediate infirmities. He must be depicted as without those graces of consciousness and spirit which perhaps constitute his true humanity. So the entire theory of realism is based on the concept that the worst is the truth, and that in order to be realistic, we must take the beauty out of things. As a result of this attitude, most modern art depicts the works of men rather than the works of nature. It's very difficult to take the beauty out of the subject. It is almost inconceivable that man can take the beauty out of a mighty mountain with a stream running at its base. But it is quite possible for man to take the beauty out of sidewalk cafes. It is possible to take the beauty out of shops and stores and factories. And it is very easy to take the beauty out of modern architecture because there was not much there in the first place. So the realist, selecting carefully those things in which human limitations are most obvious, tries to create upon this pattern a canon of an acceptable art. It is the art of the deformed and the trivial. It is the art of the meaningless. It is a vague, vagrant experimentation with so-called artistic elements, without any insight, without any penetration, without any nobility of purpose to give vitality or integrity to these people. For these reasons and others equally valid, modern art is not honest. It is not a legitimate descendant of the great classical school. This does not mean that art cannot grow. It has always grown. It does not mean that it cannot unfold and mature and ripen. It does not mean that there is no place in it for innovation or change, no freedom of expression. What it really means is that progress in art must result from greatness of soul. And that which has no greatness of soul cannot have the dreams or the experiences within self which alone can achieve essential progress in the aesthetic. Lacking this inner capacity, the artist, if we should call him such, falls back upon tricks of the trade, falls back upon deceit, falls back upon flamboyance for values which he cannot legitimately supply. Art moving in, as Plato points out, covers not only the vast areas of natural representation, as in architecture, music, in the laying out of gardens, the painting of pictures, even going so far as the writing of poems, the marvelous painting of word pictures in the high language of Romance literature. Plato points out that art has as its final purpose its adornment of the human being himself. Beauty becomes, as Pythagoras said, the medicine of the soul. The soul, in order to interpret beauty, to express beauty from within itself, must, to a certain measure, achieve normal, achieve the rightness of its own experience. The soul has to know beauty. It has to experience the need for beauty. It has to experience the discovery of the beautiful. Thus it was that it was assumed that perhaps the soul or psychic part of man was that most closely associated with beauty, and that beauty belonged to the great descent of emotional values rather than those essentially intellectual. Yet beauty can be rationalized. It is reasonable. Yet if we go too far in the interpretation of it from a mental point of view, we are apt to destroy its sensitivity or shatter some strange mystical vibratory pattern which is associated with the great symmetry of creative art. So in the study of beauty, what man is really searching for is something that pleases him. If art is to be truly meaningful to the individual, it must bring with it an instinctive satisfaction. It must cause the person to appreciate that which is worthy of appreciation. Within his own nature, worthiness finds its valuation. So the individual will, unless injured in his aesthetic sense, he will inevitably value that which is valuable. He will find the instinct to select that which is the best which he can appreciate. Thus the individual enjoys art. He likes to live with it. He likes to be surrounded by things of beauty and of charm and of graciousness. He likes to find in art also a certain measure of instruction. And this is one of the very sensitive points in modern art. The concept today is that art must have no instructional value. Of course, there is one modern school, well to the left of center, that insists that all art must have social significance. It must be propaganda. And propaganda, in this case, is nearly always a frontal attack upon privileged classes or groups. The propaganda, therefore, of the modern left bank artist is distinctly a socialistic or communistic propaganda. In order to achieve, however, propaganda, the person must thrust his own interpretations upon nature. He must use art as a means of selling or overselling an idea of his own, which may or may not have any solid substance in the great realities of life. Thus, art with social significance is really a highly conditioned form of advertising. It is an art of public relations. It is an art of selling the ideas, attitudes, or convictions of the artist to the beholder. Now, for the most part, while we don't realize this, we allow to come into our homes today works of art which we give honored places. Yet the artist who painted these things would not be an acceptable guest. We would not joy is company. We would find that he is a bore, that he is a dissipated and profane person with very few ideals and practically no gentility. We would not want to associate with him, but we will pay a fortune for his production, simply because they have been highly commercially exploited. To the Greeks, this type of the use of art is a blasphemy, a profaning of a great and noble value. We do not use great things to achieve small ends. We do not bind noble institutions to the fulfillment of the passing whims of generations. And in art, we have no right to use it primarily as a means of exploiting ideas. So the classical masters and the philosophers of art tell us frankly that all art has to have meaning. That an art that is absolutely meaningless is sterile. That an art that conveys nothing cannot convey even itself. We look at a picture, if it means absolutely nothing, we turn from it. We're not interested in it. If it awakens no values within ourselves, if it inspires no nostalgic reminiscences, if it suggests no escapes from the monotony of our daily existence, if it seems to possess no virtues and no values, we simply walk away untouched by it. Therefore, while an art should not oversell, it certainly cannot be without some form of reason for its own existence. An art which exists only to support the artist is of no value to anyone. Consequently, we must recognize that great art, which has survived because of some intangible importance in its very structure and nature. Until the dawn of what we call modern times, nearly all great art was religious. It might not be obviously, but for the most part, art was used as a means of revealing ideals. It was not preaching entirely, rather it was teaching. It did not need to preach because the common message which it conveyed was known already to all concerned. But it made a gracious, new presentation of this traditionally acceptable message. Consequently, we will find in Europe thousands of Madonnas by great artists, literally thousands of holy families, and probably almost as many crucifixions and resurrections, to say nothing of an endless pageantry of saints, martyrs, angels, and related themes. These art productions belong to their time. Many of them would be regarded today as over-sentimental. But they had one value about them, and that is that with a very few exceptions, they would not hurt anyone. You might feel just a little embarrassed the presence of so much piety, but there was nothing ugly about them, or at least not intentionally. Some religious themes were a little gruesome, and the martyrdom of saints was not an entirely popular subject. But at the same time, it represented an integrity. The saint was dying for his conviction. Therefore, beneath it all, the purpose was to convey value. This value made the art meaningful to its time and helped it to contribute something to the gradual spread of Christian morality. With the rise of modernism in the West, the general trend was secular in art. it became less and less a means of telling anything, until finally it became a psychological art, an art which conveyed only one message, and that is the psychic content of the artist, whether he was a sick man or a well man, whether he was a happy man or an unhappy man, whether he was dissipated and corrupted, or whether he was a person of high sentiments and values. The art became very largely psychological portraiture, and it remains that mostly to this time. The problem then comes back again as to what kind of art is useful. And the Greek would tell us rather simply, and most of the early classic artists and most of the great Oriental masters, that art is a form of ministry. It is a form of providing the individual with a new dimension of insight into value. And with all this value, not the intellectual training of the mind, but the creation of an inward joy, an inward reverence, an inward understanding or insight by which the individual was glad that this art had been made available to him, the experience added to the richness of his life. This was very largely the case in most of the great arts of Asia, and particularly perhaps in the Zen art of China and Japan. Here we are reminded again and again of the sublimity of the simple, the magnificence of the commonplace, the essential value of simple, humble things. And yet all of this art is permeated with a vast pageantry of honor and honesty. It is an art rich in reminding the individual the wonderful world that he lives in, and all that is here that is glorious and meaningful to him. The struggle between the painter's brush and the camera began to be felt in the second half of the 19th century. A great deal of art disappeared, and a great many artists turned to other trades and professions because they believed that it was impossible for the artist to compete with the lens of the camera. This was again because the artists of that time had already passed into such a photographic type of depiction that they had destroyed most of their own value. Art is not photographic reproduction of subject matter. The camera can never be equaled or excelled if you wish to produce a documentary. But a documentary conveys very little more to the beholder than he sees himself as he stands and looks out against the mountains or toward the sea. The great purpose of art is to, in one way or another, release the beauty in things through the discriminating censorship of the material involved in a picture. No great artist painting a scene ever paints it exactly as he sees it. He paints it with a certain discrimination added from his own insight. His purpose is always to remove from the scene the non-essentials which have a tendency to crowd it or to cause it to lose its essential framework. Thus, an artist painting trees against the sky will not paint them as the camera lens will represent them. He will remove certain trees that are not necessary to his picture. He will just leave them out. Or he will move the mountain a little way to the right or left. He will change things in order to bring the picture into its meaning rather than into its immediate form. Thus, as the Hermetic axiom says, art perfects nature. Art perfects it by revealing it, by releasing it, by freeing it from its own confusion. And here we have a very important point. Man is surrounded by so much that he can appreciate very little of it. Art helps to center his attention. Art captures some salient feature, quietly eliminates the rest, so that the person looking at the picture feels he has seen it all. But a large part of this seeing has been within his own consciousness. He may therefore gain a great insight and a great pleasure from the picture, which he could never gain from a faithful photograph of the same subject. The color it is the same. No man can imitate nature completely. No camera film can reproduce natural color perfectly. So the artist creates a color palette of his own, in which he very marvelously interprets and colorates his own insight. If his insight is real, if his love and respect for nature are honorable, if he possesses something within himself, the gentle, kindly, philosophic teacher, the picture will convey the lesson which he intends that it should present. But lacking these characteristics in himself, he can see no more in the object which he paints than he can bestow upon it out of his own insight. Art must therefore have meaning, but it must have studied meaning. It must have meaning that is based upon a code of value. Artists themselves must represent a standard of life, a standard of value. They must in some way be superior persons in their power to penetrate into the substances and essences of living experience. If the artist is merely one working with technique alone, he will produce soulless products, which will mean very little to himself and will have very slight surviving power. In the search for the beautiful, man also has to realize that his ability to create beauty and his ability to recognize beauty, both of these powers reside in some psychic dimension of his own inner life. Plotinus, in his great essay on the beautiful, tells us very clearly that beauty is a mood, a force, a power, which arising within the individual ennobles him, rededicates him to all things that are fine and true in life. Beauty is an ecstasy of the soul. It is the soul rushing forth joyously to embrace its own likeness in other things. It is truth within man finding truth in every other thing. And it is finally the truth in every other thing discovered once more within man. Therefore, it is part of this mysterious bond that ties heaven and earth together. It is like the rainbow, which is the promise of the forgiveness of God in all things. Beauty is more than merely an aesthetic thing. It is a tremendous spiritual proof of the presence of universal law and eternal principles. For all these principles in themselves are beautiful, orderly, inevitable. Everywhere in nature, law imposes itself upon structure in a lawful way. And this lawfulness returns beauty, even as we experience it in the multiform, crystal-like structures of snowflakes. Everywhere we perceive that God works with beauty to produce good. To the degree that man becomes an artist, he therefore, to a measure, plays God. He takes upon himself certain of the creative attributes of God. discovering these attributes by exploring his own inner consciousness, where he finds forever the presence of God. So the artist is a creator. He is a creator by a mysterious power of interpretation. He is not creating something from nothing, but he is taking all the things that are and rearranging them in new patterns, so that art is a new presentation of that which is itself eternal. Art is also a sort of eagerness to discover the beauty in things in which this beauty may seem to be concealed. Art is a sort of game, an internal effort to discover value, to solve the riddle which nature has confronted us with, the riddle of finding the good in things which seem to be bad, the finding the eternal in things that seem to be born and die, to find the unchanging nature of the infinite in things which appear to be in continuous and perpetual change. All of these factors together mean that art is involved in a kind of mystical experience. And just as surely as illumination comes to the sage, so the form and nature of this illumination is very often a beautiful experience, an experience of light and color and melody and sound and harmony. The universe suddenly unfolds as a structure of eternal, imperishable beauty, so sublime that the human being is almost unable to bear the vision of its presence. Before this beauty, man falls. He sinks into the sense of his own insignificance. This beauty overwhelms him, producing a strange ecstasy in his own nature. So that everywhere the search for truth is an experience of beauty of some kind, beauty of thought, beauty of word, beauty of conduct. And everything that is worthy of emulation is worthy because it has a nature in which a man can reasonably and graciously copy or admire. So the ancients were very clear in their sense of the religious meaning of beauty. They warned against the perversion of its principles. They warned against the corruption of its very structure, or the prostitution of its principles. They also pointed out that experience, long even in olden times, indicated that as beauty fails, so peoples fail. The loss of beauty heralded the end of civilization. When men could no longer discern that which was truly noble, when they would no longer sacrifice the lesser parts of themselves to the preservation of greater good, these men were then no longer suited to preserve cultures or civilization, or to extend their dominions and domains. That people which lost beauty within itself was already dying, and in a few years its physical, visible structure would also be destroyed. Moral beauty, as we are told, has to do with the nature of conduct. And in this we also have some recommendations and suggestions out of the past. When we listen to our own voices, and we suddenly find these voices raised in anger, or in condemnation, or in great impatience, we sense immediately that the beauty has gone out of that voice. We can imagine a chorus uniting its voices in a magic anthem, in a tremendous statement of musical sublimity. And we can imagine the howling, shouting cries of a mob. Perhaps a mob such as came finally to dominate France during the Revolution. We hear in one the noble strains of an exalted spirit, and in the other bitterness, sharpness, hatred. We see in the second the horror of a world that has lost control of itself. And we have this same experience in our own daily living. We look into a mirror. We see our faces distorted by hate, anger, grievances of one kind or another. We see the motions of our bodies made brittle and unpleasing due to the stress and strain of nervous tension. We observe how worry lines the face and takes the graciousness from it. How long-held attitudes of spite and grievance drop the corners of the mouth and form sad, hard lines upon the features. We see how the lack of beauty in ourselves finally communicates itself to the body. But what we do not fully understand is that this loss of beauty is also communicating itself to the mind, to the vitality, to the structure of our fabric, and is opening us to disease and sickness and misery, and is gradually taking away from us all of these better values which we should be cultivating. So that sometimes we see in the kindly face of age the beautiful expression of a patient and enlightened soul. We sense the deep nobility, the face of Plato, and how also wisdom shone through the less attractive features of Socrates, a man not handsome in his body, but in whose eyes and in his face was a great light of insight, a great wonder of understanding. So that when a disciple was once asked how he could endure the ungainly appearance of the teacher, the disciple replied quite simply and honestly, "I had never noticed that he was not handsome." The inner life of things, shining through, not only reveals the beauty of the soul, but smooths the way of life in many, many regards and respects. It helps us to have a richer life, a happier life, kinder life. And anything which causes a symmetry to arise within ourselves is not good. Any emotion or attitude that is not beautiful is harmful. And no amount of explanation, no justification can be advanced any more than we can justify an example of bad art simply because of the time in which it was produced or the circumstances through which the artist may have passed. Bad art is bad art regardless of how, when, or where it was created. And a bad disposition is a tragedy, no matter how much the individual can apparently justify his attitude. So as we seek to make the world more beautiful through art, we also attempt to work the transformations of art upon our own character, thus leading us to a more advanced and enlightened relationship with the world in which we exist. And this brings us naturally to perhaps the crowning level of philosophy. That phase or branch which is sometimes not included within the six branches of the philosophic system, but which was essentially added by the Neoplatonists of Alexandria, who realized that the great structure of philosophy not only arose from one essential principle, but in the end must be gathered again into one essential substance. So they created the seventh branch of philosophy, which they call theurgy. And perhaps we can best describe theurgy as a divine kind of magic, It is the magic of the working of God in man. It is the magic and mystery of enlightenment. It is the alchemy of transmutation, which is accomplished as the result of what Pythagoras calls the philosophic life. So theurgy is that branch of philosophy which has been most completely neglected for nearly 2,000 years. For today, we seldom, if ever, hear any reference to the philosophic life. We know that there are many scholars and many great individuals. And we study the biographies of great philosophers and scholars, and we are told that one was a dyspeptic, another was unable to gather his resources together to maintain his own family, or a third had the most extraordinary and delinquent personal habits, and another was a political fanatic. These studies that they had made, by which they gained a great distinction for the reasonable and logical unfoldment of ideas, seemingly never touched their lives. They became learned but not wise. They became brilliant but not good. They became skillful but not happy. In some way, the wisdom which they accumulated was put away in some closet or in some department of life or hoarded in some vault where it might be protected against loss or decay, but it was never used. It was never the basis of a daily conduct. And when we think of philosophy as it is taught in modern universities, we know that some of these schools have exceptionally fine schools of philosophy. Although I think it is generally agreed that at this time, the greater weight in philosophic studies goes toward psychology, where many young people feel a brilliant profession awaits them. But in the philosophical department, you seldom, if ever, hear of the application of any system of philosophy to any person actually in trouble. They never get around to this. The student himself is not told to use his philosophy in the solution of his own problem. He is told to remember the words of the wise, to compare them, to arrange them, and if possible, to take a highly critical situation in which he seeks in every way possible to find defects in the thinking of other people. Overall is the general concept that philosophy is, after all, a kind of pedantry, a sort of a mental luxury for those who may sometime become professors or who would like, perhaps, to have the ornamentation of it in genteel letters. But philosophy is no longer regarded as a living force, even where it is taught. And if you should point out to a group of students of philosophy, perhaps working for their masters or their doctorates, that the beginning and end of philosophy is to roll up your sleeves and use it, they would consider you mad. It just has no part in the thinking of things today. But the Greeks, particularly of Alexandria, during the first three centuries of the Christian era, were convinced that all philosophy was perfected by the philosophic life, the life of wisdom. That no matter how brilliant you became, or how much you were able to remember, or how conversant you became with systems, you had only a brittle, superficial grasp of things, unless in some way you could transmute knowledge into insight and understanding within your own experience, within your own consciousness itself. Therefore, as Plotinus said to one of his young disciples, make philosophy your journey. use the philosophic system as a guide to conduct, as something to be continuously applied to the problem of your own day. It would seem very strange that an individual would spend many years studying Aristotle or Plato, and then in any difficulty that arose, had to go to someone else for help. It simply meant that this person had never really thought of philosophy as a living instrument. He thought of it only as a cultural embellishment. He thought of it as something that it was nice to know, like a good suit of clothes. It was a status symbol. If you could toss the right words around, it seemed rather important. But to use these ideas represented a new dimension of approach to wisdom. And this was what the Greek Alexandrian Neoplatonists referred to as theurgy. It was the transmuting magical power of wisdom operating in the daily life of the person. It meant that as wisdom increased, the individual increased. It meant that with every new discovery, there was new richness of character, new nobility of action. And of course, all of the theurgical arts had to do with man's victory over doubt. Doubts, in some way, were the weaknesses of men. Man, forever uncertain of his own behavior and less certain of the behavior of others, lived in a world of doubting, a world in which he had inadequate faith built upon inadequate knowledge. It was the duty, therefore, of theurgy, so to say, as a part of philosophy, to dispel man's most common and frequent doubts, particularly his doubts concerning providence, concerning God, concerning the nature of good and evil, and the eternality of the world. If man was able to clarify within himself his doubts about justice, if he could really believe to the very core of his nature that he did live in a universe that was essentially just, if he could rationally demonstrate this to himself, if he could logically prove it, if he could aesthetically justify it, if he could metaphysically experience it, if he could find in it all of the reason that was necessary to convince himself, if he could justify in his own thinking the full scope of epistemology and psychology in these respects, then, in a strange way, he came to the end of his uncertainty, his disturbances. He came finally to those certitudes which permit him to relax, to no longer struggle against unrighteous fortune, no longer to take